listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, remember that guy who, during the Bush administration back in 2004, 2005, thereabouts, when John Ashcroft had had surgery, emergency surgery, and he's laying in the hospital all drugged up and doped up, and Alberto Gonzalez needs to get a reauthorization to illegally wiretap people. And James Comey, who is Ashcroft's number two guy, gets the word that Gonzalez is on his way over to the hospital to get Ashcroft to sign off on this thing. And he's like driving through the traffic like a madman. And we've got clips of him describing it that we perhaps will play for you later on. But anyhow, he got there just as Alberto Gonzalez was arriving, or just before. And Gonzalez comes in and he says, no, sorry, the attorney general's not going to sign that. And stood there with the attorney general, who himself said he didn't want to sign it, and made the Bushies back down. Anyhow, that guy, who, of course, left the Department of Justice shortly thereafter, he is the guy that it looks like Obama is going to pick as the next FBI director. By the way, he's a Republican, and he contributed to the McCain and the Romney campaigns. Fascinating stuff. A lot of other things in the news today, too. I've got an amazing story from prison that I want to share with you today. But the U.S. Senate just put together their agriculture bill and sent it over to the House. It's got a $2 billion cut in what's called SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Programs, what used to be called food stamps. The Republicans in the House of Representatives want to cut $20 billion out of this. We have, according to the USDA, somewhere between 6 and 9 million people who are on various occasions going to sleep hungry or experiencing hunger, what's called food insecurity. But even if it was zero, you've got tens of millions of people in the United States who are so far down on the economic ladder that they're having to make choices between eating and being homeless, or eating and taking medication, or eating and, I mean, not even a choice between eating and buying insurance or something like that. And in the richest nation in the world, this is insane. This is absolutely insane. Franklin Roosevelt said, a necessitous man is not a free man. I am a big advocate of personal liberty. You are not free if you are hungry. You are not free if you are homeless. You are not free if you are sick and you don't have health care. You are not free if you are, you know, in any of these conditions. You're not free if you want to work and you can't find a job. You're not free. This is simple reality. And yet the Republicans say, oh, yeah, let's cut out some more food stamps for these people. Let's take $20 billion out of this. What kind of person would do this? Maybe Chris Edwards can give us some insight. He's the director of tax policy studies and the editor of downsizinggovernment.org over at the Cato Institute, the libertarian think tank, formerly the Charles Koch Foundation. Cato.org is their website. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm one of those evil people that would cut the food stamps, I'm afraid.
Well, I don't understand why. I don't think it's funny.
The first point I would say is, you know, looking at the numbers, the food stamp spending has quadrupled over the last decade from about $20 billion to about $80 billion a year now. And, you know, the Republicans blame it all on Obama, and that isn't true. Food stamp spending actually roughly doubled under Bush, then it roughly doubled again under Obama. And the number of people on food stamps has soared from under 20 million to now 48 million.
Of homeless people, the number of unemployed people, the number of people who are not making it in this country anymore.
Partly
you have half of America right now below the poverty
partly
level.
Partly the recession, but it is mainly because they've expanded the eligibility over and over and over for food stamps. So, like, college kids get food stamps these days, and they never used to get food stamps.
Good.
And so, I think this is the real problem, getting this many people dependent on the government. But I'm not just picking on low-income people. We had a forum today at Cato where we attacked farm subsidies. Wealthy farmers get an increasing amount of federal handouts. We're against that, too. So I want to cut the welfare for the rich people and low-income people, because I think that, you know, the federal government is just starting to control too much in the economy.
I think it's just heartless. I mean, I'm serious. I'm with you on cutting welfare for rich people. Rich people don't need it. But when you're talking about somebody who's making $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a year working at Walmart or working in the food service industry or working two and three jobs, you know, just absolute crappy jobs, or cleaning somebody's home, and they're barely making it by, and they got a couple of kids in school, and they can hardly pay their rent, and then people like you come along and say, oh yeah, let's screw them.
Okay, let me suggest this to you that we might agree on. I think that there's a lot that the federal government can do to actually lower prices and make life easier for low-income Americans without subsidizing them.
For example, raising the minimum wage.
Farm bill, for example, the federal government runs a massive dairy program that subsidizes dairy farmers and raises the price of milk and cheese and other dairy products. I would get rid of that sort of program that harms low-income people and also screws taxpayers just for the benefit of wealthy producers.
You know what harms low-income people, Chris? Low incomes.
Right. And
so let's do something about that. Let's say that if your patrons, if
the price of food.
No, let's say that if your patrons, if the Koch brothers or if any other industrialist in the United States, any business, period, whether it's this my small business or whether it's their big business, any business in America that refuses to pay a living wage has no business being in business in America. The economy has doubled since Reagan took office. During the 33 years of Reaganomics now, from the time of George Washington until the time of Ronald Reagan, productivity and wages both went up, and they tracked each other almost perfectly. There were a few bumps along the way that usually had to do with wars, but they tracked each other almost perfectly. Now, since Reagan, productivity has continued to go up. And if wages had continued to rise as they were in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, along with productivity, right now the average household wage instead of being $44,300 would be $90,000. Those people would be paying more taxes. You'd have no problem with Social Security or Medicare. You'd have no problem with a deficit. You would have your middle class back. But instead, wages have been flat since Reagan. Productivity continues to go up. And what has filled that gap is the top 1% and the corporations of America taking trillions, literally with a T, trillions of dollars out of the economy, putting it in Swiss banks, putting it in the Cayman Islands, stashing it offshore, and the rest of us get screwed. The problem with low-wage workers is low wages. Let's fix that.
You seem to have it all figured out, and I would suggest
I do.
That all of this data is a lot more complex than you might think it is.
No, it's not.
I'll give you one example. The data that shows a supposed increasing income separation in America, more poor people, more rich people, the data has a lot of problems, and one of them is this, that more and more, there's more single family parents in America, more divorce than ever before. And
what happens when your economy sucks is people break up.
The stress is reflected in high divorce rates. Married couples who stay married tend to have higher incomes because their incomes are combined. Couples that separate and single family parents. I have more lower.
Chris, look at the statistics over the last. No, no, Chris, hang on just a second. Before you go any farther with this, look at the last 50 years, and you will see that whenever we go into recession, divorce goes up. Suicide goes up, divorce goes up. Whenever we go into a recession, whenever we're in a boom time, suicide goes down, divorce goes down.
So we should. I agree with you. We shouldn't have recessions then. And I've got.
Well, historically, the way we dealt with recessions is with a social safety net. We said when capitalism goes through its inevitable cycles. When capitalism fails, then the government steps in and says, here's your unemployment benefits, here's your food stamps, here's your housing support.
I don't think this recent recession was a business cycle. It was caused by government policy in my view.
Absolutely. It was caused by Phil Graham deregulating the banks.
Well, it was Bill Clinton, actually.
Well, it was during the... Clinton signed the legislation, I'll give you that. But it was proposed by the Republicans and pushed by Phil Graham, whose wife was on the board of Enron. This was all about Enron. Chris Edwards, Director of Tax Policy Studies, DownsizingGovernment.org, Cato.org. Thanks, Chris.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Chris was in a hurry to get off the line there. So, well, anyhow, we'll be back 15 minutes past the hour. As you may know, progressives know how to party. Are you in the L.A. area? You can join me, Lily Tomlin, Jim Hightower, John Nichols, and other special guests at the Progressive Democrats of America annual. This is a small get-together and fundraiser maximum 50 people this Saturday, June 1st. It's at a private home in Beverly Hills. And for information on that, go to PD America, as in Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. Click on the events tab, and you can scroll down to the Lily Tomlin, Tom Hartman gig. Or you can, there's a link at tomhartman.com. And it'd be great to see you on Saturday if you're in the L.A. area. It should be a lot of fun. So, wow. James Comey as the next director of the FBI. He was kind of a hero for me when he stood up to Alberto Gonzalez and said, no, wiretapping is illegal. The guy's a Republican. He's a conservative. I understand that. Some of these law and order by the book guys are just like, that's how they're wired. And, you know, hopefully he's not a, in fact, I would say, absolutely, he's not a partisan Republican. If he was, he would have said to Alberto Gonzalez, oh, well, you know, if the president of the party wants to illegally wiretap people, that's fine with me. So he's not a get-along, go-along guy. He's been working as a lawyer for a defense contractor, Lockheed Martin, and with the investment firm Bridgewater Associates. This is where high-level administration bureaucrats go to retire, is with the big companies. But I think this may be actually some good news for the FBI. We'll see. It'd be really interesting to see if you get a real law and order guy like James Comey. I mean, a guy who's like the real law and the real order, regardless of the political consequences. If he might start going after banksters, for example. Or if he might start going after some of the fraud that's happening in the lobbying business, you know, here in Washington, D.C. There's a lot of possibilities. A lot of possibilities. So we'll see how all that shakes out. There's a woman in El Salvador who, in El Salvador, it is illegal to have an abortion, period, even if the life of the mother is at stake. And her life is at stake. She has lupus, which is a life-threatening illness. And she is pregnant with a child who has, I want to say encephalopathy, but it's actually worse than that. This child is not only missing its brain, it's missing part of its skull. And I shouldn't call it this child. It is, you know, a fetus, and she's about halfway through the pregnancy. And she's in the hospital. They're watching her because, you know, it's illegal to get an abortion or cause yourself to abort in El Salvador. No doctor can perform an abortion. And she's appealed to the Supreme Court of the country. And her doctors are saying that if she gives birth to this child, it will be in excruciating pain and it will die within a few days. And if it's feeling pain, it's probably already in excruciating pain. And there's a very good chance she will die. And the Supreme Court, El Salvador Supreme Court, yesterday decided to deny her a life-saving abortion. This is interesting. And then the CEO of Exxon, Rex Tillerson. This is my definition of a sociopath. Now, maybe Rex Tillerson is a wonderful family guy who really does care about the future of the planet and the future of his grandchildren and all those kind of things, and he's not a sociopath. I don't know. I've never met the guy. But when people say things like this, it makes me wonder that what good is it to save the planet if humanity suffers? Right? And really, I think what he's saying, and this was at their stockholder meeting, what good is it to save the planet if profits suffer? Also at their stockholders meeting, there was a proposal put forward by Sonia Kowal. And she said, I'm with Zevin Asset Management. I'm moving proposal number 8 on the proxy, which asks ExxonMobil to conduct a study, not even to do anything, just study it, the feasibility of refraining from all political giving and then report on the findings of that study to its shareholders. She said similar resolutions have been filed at Target, Chevron, 3M, EQT, and Bank of America. She says the Citizens United Supreme Court decision opened the gates for corporations to spend unlimited amount interim selections, and the result was that 2012 was the most expensive election year ever. And we believe ExxonMobil wishes and intends to be a good corporate citizen, and this would be good governance, and quack, 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 but it got voted down. Surprise! So, Mayor Bloomberg got a letter yesterday with ricin in it. And a lot of nasty words, basically. You know, this came from Louisiana saying, how dare you want to do gun control? He's actually gotten two of these letters. And President Obama apparently got one today. Or at least, you know, one was addressed to him. I'm sure he didn't get it, but it was intercepted long before it got to him. And Bloomberg's response to this guy who is basically threatening his life is to issue a statement saying there are 12,000 people who are going to get killed this year with guns and 19,000 who are going to commit suicide with guns, and we're not going to walk away from these efforts to stop this. Good on you, Mayor Bloomberg. I just absolutely believe that cities, counties, towns, states should be able to pass laws if they choose to that limit weapons of war or, you know, that limit access to guns if that's the community's choice. The single exception to that should be if there's a well-regulated militia in that state. And if you're a member of the National Guard, then, you know, your right to own a gun shall not be abridged. I mean, you might want to have to take it up with your commander. Oh, speaking of commanders and COs, I've got this incredible letter from prison I want to share with you. And we'll pick up some of your calls here. But it's from the one guy who is in prison right now because the Bush administration was torturing people. Tell you about that after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yes, you heard that right. There is a guy in prison because the Bush administration was torturing people. Turns out he's the guy who blew the whistle and told us about it. 33 minutes past the hour. Exposing the Con and Conservative Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. A 2-year-old boy in Texas was pronounced dead yesterday after shooting himself in the face with his grandfather's 9mm loaded handgun. Brilliant. Both grandma and grandpa were home along with a couple of his siblings. Another day, another dead kid. And Wayne Little Peter, no, wait a minute, La Petite, right? No, Little Pierre. No, what's his name? Wayne LaPierre, that's right, which I guess is French for Little Peter. Anyway, Wayne Little Peter, smallpenisgunclub.net, by the way, it's up. It's getting there. Okay, smallpenisgunclub.net, and we'll have to see if we're .org and .com are pointing to. Anyhow, another day, another 2-year-old dead. And, by the way, Wayne Little Peter is making $2 million a year. I don't know what that works out to on a per-day basis. There's roughly, if you take vacation days and everything else, there's 240 work days in a year. So let's say that there's 200 work days for Wayne Little Peter. And 200 goes into a million. I can't do my math that fast. 100 going into a million would be $10,000 a day. So he must make $5,000 a day. Do I have that right? Roughly, maybe $4,000 a day. So, another day, another dead kid, another $4,000 for Wayne LaPierre. Letter from Loretto. John Kiriakou is the only guy who's in prison because George Bush and Bush and Gonzalez and Jay Bybee, who is now a judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, believe it or not. And John Yoo, who mind-bogglingly is a professor of law, I believe, a professor in any case at the University of California, Berkeley. Can you imagine taking a class from a guy who, like, helped your country torture people and destroyed the reputation of your country? I'd have a real problem with that. Anyhow, and Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice, there's basically about 20 people in the Bush administration who put together this whole let's torture people plan. Let's violate the Geneva Conventions. Let's do what they actually executed, what the United States executed Japanese soldiers for doing in the Philippines. Let's do what the Nuremberg tribunals prosecuted Nazis for doing after World War II. Let's do that ourselves and become pariahs, make the Muslim world think that we're at war against them. And the one guy who had the intestinal fortitude to stand up and say, no, this isn't right, I'm going to go to the press with this and blow the whistle, John Kiriakou, he is in prison. And he wrote a letter. It's an amazing letter. It's reprinted in many places over the web. I got my copy from firedoglake.com, which has a, you can actually see the original, and you can print out the text and all that. So I printed out the text. I want to share it with you. This is his letter. Because it provides an amazing insight into life in prison. He says, greetings from the Federal Correctional Institute at Loretto, Pennsylvania. I arrived here on February 28th, 2013 to serve a 30-month sentence for violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act of 1982. At least that's what the government wants people to believe. In truth, this is my punishment for blowing the whistle on the CIA's illegal torture program and for telling the public that torture was official U.S. government policy. But that's a different story. The purpose of this letter is to tell you about prison life. At my formal sentencing hearing in January, the judge, the prosecutors, and my attorneys all agreed that I would serve my sentence in Laredo's federal work camp. When I arrived, however, much to my surprise, the corrections officer, this is CO, they're also called hacks, the CO who processed me said that the Bureau of Prisons had deemed me a, quote, threat to the public safety, end quote, and so I would serve the entire sentence in an actual prison rather than at the camp, which is a, you know, little friendlier place. Processing took about an hour, included fingerprinting, a mugshot, my third after FBI and the Marshals, my fourth DNA sample, and a quite comprehensive strip search. I was given a pair of baggy brown pants, two brown shirts, two pairs of underwear, two pairs of socks, and a pair of cheap sandals. My own clothes were boxed and mailed to my wife. The CO, corrections officer, then led me to a steel bunk in central unit and walked away. I didn't know what to do, so I took a nap. My cell is more like a cubicle made out of concrete block. Built to hold four men, mine holds six. Most others hold eight. My cellmates include two Dominicans serving 24 and 20-year sentences for drugs, a Mexican serving 15 years for drugs, a Puerto Rican serving 7.5 years for drug conspiracy, and the former auditor of Cuyahoga County, Ohio, who's doing a long sentence for corruption. They're all decent guys, and we actually enjoy each other's company. The prison population is much like you might expect. Loretta has 1,369 prisoners. I never call myself an inmate. I'm a prisoner. About 50% are black, 30% Hispanic, 20% are white. Of the white prisoners, most are pedophiles with personal stories that would make you sick to your stomach. The rest of the white prisoners over here are here for drugs, except for a dozen or so who ran Ponzi schemes. Of the 1,369 prisoners, 40 have college degrees and 6 of us have master's degrees. The GED program is robust, but when I volunteered to teach a class, my counselor shouted, damn it, Kiriakou, if I wanted you to teach an effing class, I'd ask you to teach an effing class. So I'm a janitor in the chapel. I make $5.25 a month. The cafeteria or chow hall was the most difficult experience of my first few days. Where should I sit? On my first day, two Aryans, completely covered in tattoos, walked up to me and asked, are you a pedophile? Nope, I said. Are you a fag? Nope. Have you got good paper? I didn't know what this meant. It turned out that I had to get a copy of my formal sentencing documents to prove that I wasn't a child molester. I did that and was welcomed by the Aryans, who aren't really Aryans, but more accurately, self-important hillbillies. The cafeteria is very formally divided. There is a table for the whites with good paper, a section of the table for the Native Americans, a section of a table for people belonging to a certain Italian-American stereotypical subculture, two tables for the Muslims, four tables for the pedophiles, and all the remaining tables for the blacks and Hispanics. We don't all eat at the same time, but each table is more or less reserved, as I described. Violence hasn't been much of a problem since I arrived. There have been maybe a half dozen fights, almost always over what television show to watch. The choices are pretty much set in stone between ESPN, MTV, VH1, BET, and Univision. I haven't watched TV since I got here. It's just not worth the trouble. Otherwise, violence isn't a problem. Most of the guys in here have worked their way down to a low-security prison from medium or maximum, and they don't want to go back. I've also had some luck in this regard. My reputation preceded me, and a rumor got started that I was a CIA hitman. The Aryans whispered that I was a Muslim hunter to the Muslims. on the strength of my Arabic language skills and a well-timed statement of support from Louis Farrakhan. Instead, the Muslims have lauded me as a champion of Muslim human rights. Meanwhile, the Italians have taken to liking me because I'm patriotic, as they are, and I have a visceral dislike of the FBI, which they do as well. I have good relations with the blacks because I've helped several of them write commutation appeals or letters to judges, and I don't charge anything for it. And the Hispanics respect me because my cellmates, who represent a myriad of Latin drug gangs, have told them to. So far, so good. The only thing close to a problem I've had has been from the COs. So this is the correctional officers. When I first arrived, after about 4 days, I heard an announcement that I was told to dread. Kiriakou, report to the lieutenant's office immediately. Very quickly, I gave my wife's phone number to a friend and asked him to call her if, for some reason, I was sent to the SHU, Special Housing Unit, also known as the Hole, or Solitary Confinement. I hadn't done anything wrong, but this kind of thing happens all the time. When I got to the lieutenant's office, I was ushered into the office of SIS, the Special Investigative Service. This is the prison version of every police department's detective bureau. I saw on a desk a copy of my book, The Reluctant Spy, as well as DVD copies of all the documentaries I've been in. The CO showed me a picture of an Arab. "Do you know this guy?" he asked me. I responded that I'd met him a day earlier, but our conversation was limited to "nice to meet you." Well, the CO said, "This guy is the uncle of the Times Square bomber," and after we met, he called a number of Pakistanis, reported the meeting, and was told to kill me. I told the CO that I could kill the guy with my thumb. He's about 5'4 and 125 pounds compared to my 6'1, 250. The CEO said they were looking to ship him out, so I should stay away from him. The more I thought about it, the more this made no sense. Why would the uncle of the Times Square bomber be in a low-security prison? He should be in maximum. So I asked my Muslim friends to check him out. It turns out that he's an Iraqi Kurd from Buffalo, New York. He was the imam of the mosque there, which also happened to be the mosque where the Lackawanna Seven worshipped. The Lackawanna Seven were charged with conspiracy to commit terrorism. The FBI pressured him to testify against his parishioners. He refused and got 5 years for obstruction of justice. The ACLU and several religious freedom groups have rallied to his defense. He had nothing to do with terrorism. In the meanwhile, the SIS told him that I had made a call to Washington after we had met and that I had been instructed to kill him. We both laughed at the ham-handedness by which the SIS tried to get us to attack each other. If we had, we would have spent the rest of our sentences in the SHU in solitary. Instead, we're friendly, we exchange greetings in Arabic and English, and we chat. The only other problem I had with the COs was about 2 weeks after I arrived. I get a good deal of mail here in prison. I answer every letter I get. Monday through Friday, prisoners gather in front of the unit CO's office for mail call. One female CEO butchers my name every time she says it. When she does me on mail call, I hear her go, "Kirakau, Kiraku, Teriyaki," and a million other variations. One day after mail call, I passed her in the hall. She stopped me and said, "Are you the MF-er whose name I can't pronounce?" I responded, "Kiriaku." She said, "How if I just call you F-Face?" I just walked away, and a friend I was walking with said, "Classy." I said to him, "White trash is more like it." And an hour later, four COs descended on both of our cells, trashing all of our worldly possessions in my first shakedown. Lesson learned. COs treat us like subhumans, but we have to show them respect even when it's not earned.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There's just a sentence at the end of this, including his address. I'll share it with you when we come back from the break in about 5 minutes. So here's how he wraps it up. This letter so touched me. The other guy who, by the way, if you write him a letter, he will respond to you. I've corresponded with him several times. Is Don Siegelman. And Don Siegelman is America's political prisoner. You can get Don Siegelman's information over at free-don.org. And I'm pretty sure that they have his address in prison over there. But this is John Kiriakou. He's the guy who outed Bush's torture program. And none of the torturers went to prison. Nobody from the Bush administration went to prison. The people who devastated who destroyed the reputation of this country didn't go to prison. The people who killed people didn't go to prison. The people who caused, hundreds of people to be stuck in Guantanamo, unprosecutable because their confessions were extracted under torture, so they're meaningless. They can't be used in a court of law, and they may or may not be true. None of those people went to prison. But John Kiriakou did. Anyhow, he says, "I'll write about COs more next time. If you'd like to drop me a line, I can be reached at John Kiriakou, 79637-083, P.O. Box 1000, FCI Loretto, Pennsylvania, 15940. Best regards from Loretto, John. Very nice letter. As I said, you can find it over at Fire Dog Lake. Well, there will be a link to it tomorrow in Sue's Daily Stack, and we'll get all that information in our newsletter and all that kind of stuff if you want to track it down. But I just thought that was fascinating, just absolutely fascinating. Craig, in Blanchardville, Wisconsin, you want to disagree with me?
Well, with regard to the boy that died in a gun accident in Texas, you said another day and another child's dead.
Yeah.
But, I mean, how many...
We average about two dead kids a day.
And how many die in car accidents in a typical day?
Well, when you use a gun, you are... a gun is a device that is designed to kill people. A car is not. I mean, there are more people who die slipping in their bathtub than who commit voting fraud in the United States. I mean, it's a very low number, but still, people slip in the bathtub. I wouldn't outlaw bathtubs. I'm not going to outlaw cars. We need cars to get around. We don't need guns to get around.
We have a constitutional right to have guns.
You have a constitutional right to have a militia.
Well, you don't have to fire a gun to use it. Just having a gun is often enough.
Yeah, it's enough to get your kid killed.
To protect yourself.
From what?
From anyone that might want to break in or attack you.
Yeah, has that ever happened to you in your life? Have you ever protected yourself with a gun? I don't know anybody who has. I've been asking.
Never been in a car wreck either.
Pardon?
No, and I've never been in a serious car wreck either. But
okay, well, I've been in two serious car wrecks. But yeah, where I ended up regretting it, shall we say.
I disagree with the point that you have to fire a gun to use a gun. Because you might have a gun, that's enough to keep people from breaking in your house.
I think, then why is it that when that county in Maryland, I think it was, published the addresses of the people who are the registered gun owners, or some group did, that those people got all hysterical and said, you can't publish our addresses, that'll encourage people to break into our houses to steal our guns. Shouldn't they have been saying, thank you for publishing our addresses, that'll discourage people from breaking into our houses because they'll be afraid of getting shot?
I could see both points.
Okay, so maybe we should publish the addresses of all gun owners. You know, I've seen the bumper stickers on the cars that say protected by Smith & Wesson. Maybe people should, put something on the outside of their house. There's a gun in this house. I suspect that, actually, as a parent, when my kids were young, I would very much like to have known which houses in the neighborhood had guns in them before my kids went over and played there. Fortunately, the only gun horror story I have is from when I myself was a teenager, and it was my best friend committing suicide with a gun. But, my kids, to the best of my knowledge, never came into contact with guns. But, a lot of kids do, and that's just, it's a sad thing. It's a sad thing. Craig, thanks for the call. I get your point. I disagree with it, but I understand it. Mark, in Germantown, Tennessee, you wanted to talk about food stamps?
Yeah, Tom. It's interesting that you talked about hunger today because, I just became aware there's the International Human Rights Clinic at the NYU Law School just came out with a report about this. And according to their findings, 1 in 6 Americans live in a home that's food insecure. There's now 50 million people who are food insecure. Right. 17 million of those are kids.
Yeah.
And to have this guy come on, it's just I applaud you for having the other, even though I don't necessarily think everything needs to be fair and balanced anymore, frankly. We need to step up.
I'm not trying to be fair and balanced. What I'm trying to do is show people how to talk back to the other side, because these guys go on the rest of the corporate media and nobody says, hey, wait a minute. They go on NPR and just, hey, blah, 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 blah. And the guy goes, oh, okay, thank you. Next question. It's like somebody needs to talk back to him.
Yeah, it's just, to hear somebody like that on there who probably has never been to Skid Row or to, into a ghetto in his life and to see what people really are going through, or even, normal middle, who used to be middle class Americans now are in the same boat.
Yep.
I mean, does this guy ever spend any time with these people?
I don't know, and I can't speak for him, and I don't think, and Chris isn't here to defend himself. And so rather than speaking of him, let's speak of the issue itself. I mean, as I've said many times on the radio or, you know, on TV here, I remember when I was six or seven years old, and my dad, you know, he couldn't get a decent job, and he was selling encyclopedias and Rex Air vacuum cleaners door to door. And we had to go to the surplus food place and get these bricks of cheese and these bags of macaroni. We ate macaroni and cheese for weeks. I remember that. And that was a social safety net that protected him, that protected us. We at least had food. And we weren't, you know, impoverished. We were just going through a rough patch. I can't, you know, I've known people who are impoverished, and it's just the stress is mind-boggling. It's just right. Mind-boggling. Of course you see divorce rates go up, and of course you see, you know, crime rates go up, frankly. The stress of this, and we're allowing this to happen in the richest country in the world. It seems so fundamentally wrong. Mark, thank you for the call. Thanks for your thoughts. In the next hour, Brian Fisher is going to be here at 5. So in the next hour, can democracy survive Republican lies? Some interesting statistics out about who's lying to the American people more, and when, and how, and why. What does that mean for democracy?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So, a few little interesting factoids, and then I want to get into this democracy thing. First of all, last night on the television machine, I was in a debate with Horace Cooper and Chris Ullman. It was the lone liberal debate. And Horace, conservative, longtime Republican, in fact, a little later on, I was debating another Republican. He says, I've known Horace for 23 years, been around the town for a while. And I said, you know, what's the deal with Michelle Bachmann? Is she resigning because she met a pollster or a prosecutor or both? And Horace said, and I'm paraphrasing, I'll have to find the clip. I'll play it for you tomorrow because I think it just went up on the internet. Should be over at Democratic Underground. It's on our YouTube channel. You can click to it, link to it off TomHartman.com. It's YouTube.com/TheBigPictureRT. But in any case, Horace said that it's his understanding. Now, this is a Republican speaking about the gossip in the Republican circles, that the Justice Department cut a deal with Michelle Bachmann that they would stop their investigation and prosecution of her if she chose not to run for office again. And then he went off on a rant about how this Obama Justice Department is the most vicious one ever, and they go off on these political witch hunts and all this kind of stuff. But that's very interesting. And if it's true, it'll be, now, you know, keep in mind, he said this on live television, so I'm not talking out of school here. And if anybody would know, I think it would be Horace. So keep an eye on that one. She's changed her Facebook page, one of the headlines over at DU. Michelle Bachmann changes her Facebook page to Boring Seagulls. No crimes here. Meanwhile, Costco. You know, Costco competes with Sam's Club. Louise and I actually had a Costco membership for a couple of years back when we had a car. We no longer have a car, and I don't know if there's a Costco around here, but in any case, it's when we lived in Oregon. I haven't had a car for 3 years. But, you know, it's one of these, the big box store of big box stores. I mean, you know, big, you know, large quantities and all that kind of. The average Costco employee makes $45,000 a year. Average Walmart employee, Walmart competes with Costco, makes $17,486 a year. Costco just announced a quarterly profit of $459 million. Not too shabby, huh? You can do good, you can do well by doing good. So, just a note. Thomas Jefferson once said that an enlightened citizenry is indispensable for the proper functioning of a republic. Self-government is not possible unless the citizens are educated sufficiently to enable them to exercise oversight. It is therefore imperative that the nation see to it that a suitable education be provided for all its citizens. End of quote. Now, having an enlightened and educated citizenry is a great ideal to strive for in theory, but doing it in the real world, not so easy. This is especially true when those that we're supposed to trust, like, for example, our elected officials in Washington, D.C., when they choose to lie to the American people over and over again rather than face or tell the facts. And when it comes to lying lawmakers, it turns out Republicans are the worst. I mean, by big margin. George Mason University's Center for Media and Public Affairs analyzed 100 statements, 46 by Democrats, 54 by Republicans, that were fact-checked by the Tampa Bay Times' PolitiFact organization between January 20th, basically the first of this year, and May 22nd. Last week, I guess. The center found that 52% of Republican claims reviewed by PolitiFact were rated mostly false, false, or pants on fire, which is, like, incredibly false. While just 24% of Democratic statements were given one of those ratings. Similarly, 54% of Democratic statements were rated as mostly true or true, while only 18% of Republican statements achieved that rating of true. So here we have empirical proof that Republicans lie, and they lie a lot. I mean, that wouldn't be such a bad thing if the Republicans just lied to themselves, if they weren't able to spread their lies to the masses. But the mainstream media loves to let Republicans come on TV and spew lies and misinformation. Media Matters looked up the makeup of guests on the major Sunday morning talk shows during the first quarter of this year. Now? I mean, back when Bush was in power, they were saying, oh, we get mostly Republicans, all the big networks, ABC, NBC, CBS. There was, you know, a majority of their guests on their Sunday morning shows were Republicans. And they said, well, that's because, you know, you've got a Republican administration. These are the people who are the newsmakers. These are the people who have power. So, of course, we're going to have them on. Well, now you've got a Democratic administration, democratically controlled Senate. Still, of the 400 guests who appeared on ABC's This Week, CBS's Face the Nation, NBC's Meet the Press, and Fox's Fox News Sunday, 40% were either Republicans or conservatives, and only 29% were Democrats or progressives. The rest were like journalists and things like that. And when you consider that millions of Americans tune into these shows each and every Sunday, the profound effect that the Republican lie and misinformation machine has on the American electorate, I mean, it's mind-boggling. I consider the kind of lies that the Republicans are telling the American people. They lie about Obama and health care, for example. Here's an example. In the run-up to the 2012 presidential election, then-candidate for Vice President Paul Ryan told a crowd in Florida that death panels do indeed exist.
We love you, Paul, but I'm getting along in years. Would you address the death panels that we're going to have?
The death panels, well, that's not the word I choose to use to describe it. It's actually called, so in Medicare, what I refer to this board of 15 bureaucrats, it's called the Independent Payment Advisory Board. It sounds fairly innocuous.
Right. Well, as we know, there is no such thing as death panels in any portion of the Obamacare legislation. And the Independent Payment Advisory Board that Ryan talks about, lied about, has no ability to ration health care. Next, there are the lies about guns and gun violence in America. Just days after the Newtown tragedy last December, Congressman Louie Gohmert went on Fox News Sunday and said that concealed carry laws reduce the level of gun violence. Take a listen to this.
And the facts are that every time guns have been allowed, concealed carries have been allowed, the crime rate has gone down.
Not so much. According to the Washington Post fact checker site, Gohmert's statement that concealed carry laws reduce gun violence is pretty much impossible to prove. And in fact, on the other hand, most of the evidence out there disputes the claim. Then there are the Republican lies about Social Security programs, social welfare programs like Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. Lindsey Graham is one of the biggest culprits when it comes to lying about the state of America's social welfare program. In an interview on CBS's Face the Nation last December, Graham said that America's social welfare programs were going bankrupt. Do we have time to play that clip? Okay, here it is.
I think we're going over the cliff. It's pretty clear to me they've made a political calculation. This offer doesn't remotely deal with entitlement reform in a way to save Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security from imminent bankruptcy. It raises $1.6 trillion on job creators that will destroy the economy, and there are no spending controls.
Right. Raising taxes on rich people. We can't have that. Lindsey Graham was lying. Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, they're all doing just fine. They're far from going broke. Small tweaks, everything's fine. And rich people aren't job creators. They're the takers who are busy stashing American money overseas. The job creators are the everyday working people who spend every penny of their paycheck creating demand that drives our economy.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Bottom line, Republicans lie. And as long as Republicans lie like this, 3-1 against Democrats, how can we have a functioning republic? Hey, Geeky Science Thursday. Every week, my producers, that would be my senior producers, Sean and Louise, give me 2 or 3 minutes where I can talk about my favorite topic, which is science. I mean, it's like I just love science. So let's get geeky on gut bacteria. Last week, I told you how the parasite that causes malaria can influence the brain of mosquitoes, making them more attracted to human body odor. Well, researchers have now discovered that a bacteria that you and I eat in our food may have an effect on our brain function. These findings come after a study that monitored healthy women who ate yogurt. Many of the yogurts on the market contain what are called prebiotics or probiotics, which are different types of bacteria that are a variety of different types of bacteria that are beneficial to our health, especially our gut health, our intestinal health. So in this study, researchers divided healthy women, 36 healthy women, into three groups. One group was given a specific yogurt to eat over the course of the study that contained a mix of several probiotics. Second group was given a dairy product that tasted like yogurt but had no probiotics, had no bacteria. And the third group got nothing at all. After the women had consumed or not consumed the products for a month, for 4 weeks, the researchers examined their brains by taking MRI scans and comparing them to MRI scans taken before the study had begun. The researchers also examined all the women during a state of rest and in response to an emotion recognition task in which they viewed a series of pictures of people with angry or frightened faces and then had to match the pictures to other faces showing the same emotion. The researchers, the scientists, examined the MRIs and the data from the emotion recognition task, and they found that compared with the women who did not consume the yogurt, or the bacteria, actually, those who did had a decrease in activity in the insula. It's a region of the brain which processes and integrates internal body sensations like those that come from our gut. And women who ate the prebiotic yogurt also had a decrease in the engagement and activity of portions of the brain that control things like emotion, cognition, and sensory-related responses. This is all a fancy way of saying that the women who ate the yogurt were not as reactive as the women who didn't. They were more able to deal with this kind of stuff. Scientists are now taking the findings from the study and using them to help examine the benefits that certain probiotics in yogurt may have on mood symptoms like anxiety and depression. So it's just one more thing that helps us understand more and more about the roles that microorganisms play in our everyday lives. And as it turns out, you might really be what you eat. Yeah. 90% of our cells are not human. 99% of the DNA in our body is not human. We are trillions and trillions and trillions of cells that aren't even human. They're bacteria and fungi and viruses and all kinds of amazing stuff. And it actually affects how we behave. Marco in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, says you want to disagree with me, so you're at the top of the list. What's up?
Man, listen. I listen to you all the time, and it's nice, but everybody's talking around the point. This country is so violent. This is the bully of planet Earth talking about, everybody's acting like they're so afraid to have guns, and you have a gun in the house and I can't come over there. It's a fraud. This is a monster, monster. This is the violent monster of planet Earth. The population in this country is so violent. And for Republicans, Democrats, Independents, white people, black people, to act like they're so thrown off and they're so afraid to have a gun in the vicinity is a fraud. This man, the black president, is bombing at least three, four African countries right now. AFRICOM is going in there raping Africa the way Europe, America, England, France, Germany has always done under a black president. He's no different than in the previous presidents, but because he sings Al Green, this man has a kill list.
Yeah.
Of American citizens.
I know that, Marco, and I disagree with him on that, and I think it's wrong that he's doing that, and I think that there should be due process associated with that. But to say that that Obama is the same as George W. Bush, George W. Bush was torturing people, George W. Bush was declaring an unending, eternal war on terror where the battlefield is the entire world, okay. That's just wrong. You're just wrong, respectfully.
Obama is going into Pakistan. He's threatening and bullying Syria right now, who hasn't attacked.
Oh, I know, and I think Syria has the potential to become the next Sarajevo in 1917. You know, where I think it was 1917, whatever the year was, where Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated in Sarajevo, and that set off World War I. I mean, you've got the Russians providing surface-to-air missiles. Now, why are they providing surface-to-air missiles? Because the president is asking for a no-fly plan to be drawn up, which means that we're going to start patrolling planes over the sky. Israel's talking about, well, you can't have surface-to-air missiles because they can reach us. They could take our planes even over Israel. You've got Hezbollah, which has said we're on the side of the Syrian government. You got John McCain. This is the most bizarre part. John McCain, the president and Vladimir Putin, Barack Obama and Vladimir Putin have talked to, the president has talked to the Syrian rebels, and Putin has talked to Assad, to the Syrian government, and they've said, okay, let's meet in Geneva on June 6th for peace talks. And so what does John McCain do? He goes over there and talks to the rebels and says, we got to arm these guys. Let's pass some legislation through the Senate. Let's get, you know, he blows up the peace talks. I mean, Marco, you can't lay all this at the feet of Barack Obama. I disagree with much of his foreign policy, but I think it's a hell of a lot better than George Bush's. And I agree with you that America is behaving like an empire, and we shouldn't. We need to dial back. We need to go back to minding our own business. We need to listen to George Washington in his farewell address. I'm with you on that. You know, there's a reason why they're coming after us and not after Canada.
Chicago is ground zero for violence on planet Earth. That's been a gun.
No, that's not true. Baghdad right now is probably ground zero, or the DRC, actually.
Okay, but...
Or northern Sudan. I've been in northern Sudan. I've watched a village being burned, as you know, by the ginger weed, the janja weed, the soldiers hired by Bashir al-Assad or whatever his name is. I'm mixing up my Bashirs and my Assads, but the guy who's the head of North Sudan in Darfur. I mean, I've been there, I've seen it. And Chicago ain't got nothing going on compared to that. It is a mess, but it's nothing like that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And to the extent that Chicago's a mess, it's a mess because of 33 years of Reaganomics. And let's just be honest about that. Hey, progressives know how to party. You in Los Angeles, join me, Lily Tomlin, Jim Hightower, John Nichols, and other special guests at the PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, annual get-together and fundraiser this Saturday, day after tomorrow, June 1st. You can go to pdamerica.org, click on the events tab, and scroll down for the information. There's a link at tomhartman.com. And this is going to be a very interesting, very fun event, and it's at a private home in Beverly Hills. There's only going to be 50 people coming, so you can be one of them if you'd like to. Go over to pdamerica.org and check it out. Should be fun. Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. A note on your science segment there. Did you know that the gene that causes resistance to Plasmodia, which is the bacteria that is malaria, causes the population, half the population, to be resistant, but the other half to be either have sickle cell anemia or become unresistant and so doomed to condemned to death. So
yes.
This was my argument why when people say that homosexuality has no place in reproduction, if we have one gene that causes resistance to bacteria but also kills half the population, I don't see why there could be other modifications within the genetic code that code for same-sex attractions.
Sure, sure. There's a variety of things that we call deviations from the norm, shall we say, and sometimes they're called illnesses and sometimes they're called skill sets, and whether it's Asperger's or whether it's ADHD or whether it's sickle cell anemia or whether being gay, whatever, there's a whole wide variety of genetic variations in the human race, and I think that all of them are there for a reason. I think that they're all the product of evolution.
Precisely the point.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about this this relativistic comparison of numbers that you had a guy call about guns and say that, look how many people are killed in car accidents. And this argument goes on and on. And it's not an argument.
It's
of practical reason.
Yeah.
And you know what I'm speaking about there. This is ridiculous. I mean, when you think about it, I think of examples that I've had. My brother was given the example of my conservative brother about how the national debt, he was saying a trillion, you know how many, a trillion in, he was saying, a million seconds ago was 2 weeks ago, a billion seconds ago was back when you were in junior high, a trillion seconds ago was, 2,000 years ago when Jesus was living, and we've got 17 trillion, so it would take us, if we paid a dollar a second, it would be 34,000. This is ridiculous. First of all, let's look at some comparative numbers. I mean, let's take the car accidents. Compared to the number of accidents, let alone the number of cars that are on the road, the number of accidents that actually kill people, there are many, 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 many accidents every day that don't kill anybody.
Sure.
And as you said, the intention of driving the car is not to kill. How about this one? The number of people killed, relativistically, by nuclear weapons is so pathetically small compared to the number of deaths, or better yet, the number of people actually killed by terrorism compared to other things. So why do we waste our time with those issues? In terms of the national debt, my response to my brother was this. Do you know how many molecules are in a drop of water? The number of water molecules in one drop exceeds by many, many magnitudes the $17 trillion that we have. So really it amounts to a drop in a bucket, doesn't it?
Right.
So these kinds of relativistic comparisons are intellectually stupid.
Yeah.
So to continue to hear these, every caller has this, and they hear them from somewhere, some Fox News comparison.
Yeah, or they get them in a viral email, the right way.
Yeah, but they make no, and so they're really bringing up, in terms of practical reason.
The next time somebody throws that trillion number at you, point out to them that, okay, and our GDP is $15 trillion a year. The GDP of the planet is $65 trillion a year. The amount of derivatives out there held by the banksters in unregulated marketplaces is between $600 and $900 trillion.
Well, and also, Tom, I heard it somewhere, and I was thinking about this too, but don't ever buy a house if you have an income, let's say you make pretty good money, $75,000 a year. You would easily qualify for, a $300,000 mortgage,
right,
which would make your GDP, your debt to GDP, 400%.
We can't have that.
Your credit cards, everything else. So, when they argue that our, we have to, as families, we have to balance our budgets. Well, as families, we actually do a lot worse job, if you want to put it in those terms, than the federal government does.
Yeah, excellent point, Paul. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Mike in Fairfax, Virginia. Hey, Mike.
How's it going?
Always nice to hear from you.
I didn't know if you saw the story about the UK government is issuing an IPO to sell off their post office.
Perhaps. It's still in process. One of the things that is pretty sure is if they do it, they're going to give 10% of it to their workers.
Yep. And then that would make them join Germany, Australia, Sweden, and a half dozen other European countries that have privatized post office.
Right.
I was just curious what you thought about those progressive policies here in America and how much the government could generate in revenue by spinning that off.
I don't think they're progressive policies, frankly, although, you know, I'm a fan of the post office. It's in our Constitution. It was invented by Ben Franklin. Well, not invented, but Ben Franklin really, you know, turned the post office into an important thing. I think that there's a role for the post office. And you and I both know that the major push against the post office is not because it's the post office. I mean, maybe in the UK it is, but here the major push against the post office is because it's the largest unionized employer in the United States. It's an anti-union push. And that's why Republicans put that poison pill in 2006 into the postal so-called reform legislation.
I would only like to comment that when that was put in place, didn't a lot of Democrats vote for that, too?
Yeah, and they had no idea that it had come back from conference committee with that embedded in it. They literally had no idea.
I think it's really unfair when they say the Republican poison pill because the Democrats voted for
a Republican put it in.
The restructuring of the unions.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it was put in by Republicans. It was promoted by the Republicans. I'll give you that the Democrats have not had the guts to take it back out again. And there's been several attempts, and they're continuing their attempts. Bernie Sanders is leading one. Raul Grijalva is leading one. And we need to do that. Mike, thanks for the call. Keith. And hang on just a second. For some reason, this isn't working. There we go. Keith in Schaumburg, Illinois. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I guess I was two phone calls too late. That Paul, I would love to get his take and your take on the Social Security Trust Fund. You played Lindsey Graham saying we're going off the cliff.
Right.
I don't agree with him.
Right.
But I've heard your long explanation about Social Security. Where is the Social Security Trust Fund at?
It's at 2.6 more or less trillion dollars.
Where is it on deposit at?
It's on deposit with they have invested the money in treasuries, the same as the Bush family invested
right.
George W. Bush's fund when he was born.
We borrow as a nation $4 billion a day right now to pay those bonds when they come due. Social Security bonds.
No, we don't borrow that money.
So
we take it out of tax money. The money that we use to pay for the war in Afghanistan. If you want to play that game.
Oh, you're saying that the $4 billion a day that the U.S. government is borrowing has nothing to do with Social Security.
No, it doesn't.
The Bank of Mellon in New York.
No, if that's the argument you're trying to make, Keith, it's one of the weakest arguments
no,
you can
no,
make
I,
because
I,
what you're
I,
suggesting
really,
is that we shouldn't have a national debt and that people shouldn't be able to buy treasury bonds. And we've had a national debt and our federal government has sold treasuries ever since the George Washington administration. Alexander Hamilton is the father of this. And he said that the reason why is people need to be able to invest in something that is absolutely rock solid and stable. And the only thing throughout the history of the United States that has been rock solid and stable and has never defaulted has been the debt of the United States government. To the extent to which you have government debt, that's the extent to which you have private sector savings. And if you look at the graphs and if you Google Stephanie Keller on this. She's a professor at Oklahoma State University, I believe it is, and the whole new money theory folks, and they've got the charts and graphs and the whole thing. Whenever you see a rapid contraction in national debt, what you see is also a rapid contraction in national savings, because this is the safest of all savings instruments, which is almost always followed by a recession.
I agree with that. I just don't agree with the premise that there's a Social Security Trust Fund.
Of course there's a Social Security Trust Fund. If there's no Social Security Trust Fund, then George W. Bush was not born a multimillionaire. When George W. Bush was born, he was born with a trust fund that had more than $1 million in it, and it was invested in treasuries. Are you trying to tell me that George W. Bush was born a pauper?
No. Tom, the
are you trying to tell me that George W. Bush was born as a leech off the rest of us because we were paying the 2 or 3 or 4% in interest treasuries?
You're talking about private money. The Federal Reserve
money is money.
$4 billion a day.
Money is money. You know, a dollar is a dollar. Whether it's George W. Bush's holding treasuries or whether it's the Social Security Trust Fund holding treasuries, they're treasuries.
Problem with you and Paul, the molecule guy. Is it some
would you prefer, Keith, that Social Security take that $2.6 trillion and buy GE stock? Is that what you're suggesting?
There is no.
Or would you prefer
no
that they put it on deposit at Wells Fargo?
The country has a $17 trillion debt.
That has nothing to do with this.
$4 billion a day.
The national debt of this country has absolutely nothing to do with Social Security. And, in fact, you can build a really strong case that you shouldn't even be considering $2.5 trillion of the national debt, because if the Social Security Trust Fund didn't exist and there wouldn't, you know, $2.5 trillion of that debt wouldn't have been so. Let me reverse that. if there was no place to put that $2.5 trillion, if you didn't have a national debt, Social Security would be in big trouble. You actually need to have a place where you can put debt. I mean, this is not rocket science. It's this whole thing of, oh, we have invested in America, therefore we have a problem? Really? Somehow that seems like an anti-American argument. I'm a fan of America, Frank.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Social Security is just fine, just like George W. Bush's trust fund is just fine. It all works out. Is it on? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ellen Ratner is in the studio with us. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a picture of yourself and the goat, probably taken by Ellen.
I'm going to Africa to take pictures just now.
Just literally.
Well, in 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks.
On the 18th.
Wow. It's amazing what you've created, the things that you've done with your life. I mean, you created this from scratch. I mean, it's just amazing. Like, I've been there. I mean, you took me there. I've seen it.
Right. Well, you can come back, Tom. We'd love to have you.
I would love to.
And anybody else who's listening, love to have you.
We have to organize that.
Okay. Well, what should I say? I don't know what to start with. I guess I should start with the Eric Holder issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because, you know, there are many groups today that decided not to go to the off-the-record briefing. There are some that went to the off-the-record briefing, and we don't know what happened. And we will find out.
Because
it's off the record. But it'll filter down because people talk to each other. And we'll investigate the leaks. But the White House today said that they didn't think anything inconsistent on trying to iron out policy, essentially, by having an off-the-record briefing with reporters.
Hmm.
Now, some of us don't agree with that.
Yeah.
And obviously New York Times, Huffington Post, and some others did not agree with that. The other thing is I called up and I said, well, you know, what were the radio reporters that were invited? And, of course, we haven't gotten a response to that.
Like zero. I didn't get an invitation.
Well, I didn't get an invitation either. Yeah. And we're at the White House. And the other radio reporters at the White House, I know, didn't get an invitation. Salem and those.
Right. Even the right-wing ones.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. So, okay.
What's particularly weird about this is if you go to an off-the-record meeting and you're off the record and they say something and you come back and report on it, you may have Eric Holder investigating you. And it's all about Eric Holder investigating reporters.
Exactly.
He's setting up a circumstance it's almost like the worst kind of PR that he could have done.
Now, it's also interesting. There is a group that protested yesterday, and they sent out a press release today, which I want to talk about. And the group is a group of people that are protesting what they consider Washington's revolving door. And it's from the left on Eric Holder because they said that he was a partner in Covington and Burling.
Fancy silk stocking law firm.
Right. And that why is there all of this revolving door between, as you would say, the banksters, people in government? And so it's not only that he's getting hits from Fox News and some of the journalists, he's also getting hits from the left.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mike Papatone has been going after him for a long, long
right.
time. He's very unhappy.
So that's kind of interesting. Let me just switch the subject to something that's kind of a little fun and nice.
Okay.
But it looks like the rover on Mars, Curiosity, NASA announced today that there are rounded stones, and that means water was once flowing on Mars.
Wow. Like river stones.
Like river stones. Like the kind you pay a lot of money for your backyard.
Which means that there was a lot of water running for thousands or hundreds of thousands
that's
of
right.
years.
It just didn't happen overnight.
Yeah. Wow.
So that's sort of a nice little thing. Also, today, the AFL-CIO announced that they are upset at Walmart and The Gap about worker safety in Bangladesh. They said that there were 40 retailers from around the world, including H&M and some others, that have agreed to safety issues in Bangladesh, but that Walmart and Gap have not agreed to these safety issues and have signed on, and they're not happy campers because, of course, that puts an unfair advantage advantage to people in, well, one, it takes advantage of people in Bangladesh, and two, if there's no safety requirements, it even though it's cheap wages plus unsafe living conditions, and American workers don't even have a chance.
Wow. Okay.
Okay, well, your friends on the right, Senator Jeff Sessions, he's the ranking Senate budget
not my friend.
Person. Yes, I always say tongue-in-cheek, guys. They said, well, this immigration bill, what the Congressional Budget Office does is they score things. In other words, they price things out.
Right.
And one of the things that they are pricing out is the cost of the immigration bill, but they're only doing it for 10 years. Now, Jeff Sessions is saying, well, because of perhaps Medicare or Medicaid or some of these issues, as these people become legal citizens, which means they will have also paid a fine and some back, back wage, not back wages, but at least
back
a fine.
Taxes or something.
Yeah, back taxes, all that kind of thing. That he said that that he wants the Congressional Budget Office to score this past 20 years, 30, 40 years down the road as to what it's going to cost. Mm-hmm. That's very, very hard to do.
Sure.
But that's some pushback next week that we're probably going to get on that Gang of Eight.
Sounds like foot dragging.
Of course it's foot dragging.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the reality check.
What else do they do?
It's Jeff Sessions.
I normally don't ask you things, but I am going to ask you, what do you think of Lincoln Chafee becoming a Democrat?
I think it's marvelous news. I think it's the acknowledgement of the Bob Dole syndrome, you know, that, and now I have a question for you. Last night on my TV show, Horace Cooper, you know Horace, he's a very well-known conservative here in town.
Right.
I brought up Michelle Bachmann, and he said that the scuttlebutt in Republican circles is that the Department of Justice told her that if she said that she would not run for office again, that they would drop the investigation of her. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think that that's a very common kind of thing that they do.
Right.
And you can ask Bob Ney about that when he comes back to town, because that's often the kind of deal they'll make. We'll drop this if you get out of Congress. We'll make sure you're not investigated, all that kind of thing. It's par for the course, and we'll be very interested to see what happens with with it. But, of course, she also couldn't win.
Yeah. Well, there's that,
that's
too.
Another big one. By the way, the president said last night at a fundraiser in Chicago that Democrats have a great chance to take the House back in 2014.
Well, that would be great.
That would be great.
If they take the House back, if they hold the Senate and Harry Reid blows up the filibuster, we could actually get things done during the last two years of Obama's
administration.
Wouldn't
it be nice?
It would.
I'm afraid...
Yeah, but, well, you know, what's amazing is that the Democrats got 1.5 million more votes than the Republicans did in 2012, and
right.
The House is still in Republican hands. I mean, this is like, you know, this whole redistricting thing and gerrymandering and everything else. Anyhow, Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com. Ellen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. We will be back with Brian Fisher, good old Brian Fisher. He's going to tell us all about the real role of women and families.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the report came out earlier this week that mothers are now the primary source of income in 40% of U.S. households. Some of them single moms, some of them married moms, but moms, women. And this produced a general freakout over at Fox so-called News. Lou Dobbs saying this was the dissolution of American society. Juan Williams agreed, according to Eric Dolan over at RawStory.com, describing it as a sign of the disintegration of marriage that would have negative consequences for generations to come. And Eric Erickson went even farther. He said, I'm so used to liberals telling conservatives that they're anti-science, but liberals who defend this and say it's not a bad thing are very anti-science. When you look at biology, when you look at the natural world, the role of a male and female in society and other animals, the male typically is the dominant role. I'm guessing that Eric Erickson has never heard of wolf packs or lion dens or, well, in any case. Or maybe he's never been married for years and years. Brian Fisher on the line with us. He is the host of Focal Point Radio Show on AFR Talk, Director of Issues and Analysis for Government and Public Policy for the American Family Association, AFA.net. And, Brian, you made some remarks about this a couple days ago that have been migrating across the Internet. You want to tell us what you had to say?
Well, it's interesting, Tom, that Salon.com picked up on the things that I had said, that God has designed men to be breadwinners, providers, protectors for their families. And Salon tried to paint me as a Neanderthal Cro-Magnon, but then they wound up saying, you know, I think you might be right.
And women to be subservient to their husbands?
Well, women, I think, desire men who are strong, who will protect them, who will lead them, and provide for them. I think that is the hunger of virtually the heart of every woman. If a woman doesn't
How
want
would
that,
you know what, that, Brian? What, you're a man.
If a woman doesn't want that, nobody's going to make her look for it.
You may be looking at some small slice of culture or too much porn or something. I mean, this seems like this is the stereotype of women that leads to this rape culture in our society, that women are these weak victims, they're objects, I don't know where to begin with this. I mean, it seems somewhere between misinformed and misogynistic. What about women being equal with men? Different. I mean, we have to acknowledge the differences. You and I can't have babies. We have lower pain thresholds than women do. We will live a shorter lifetime than women do. I don't see how out of that you can say that we are the stronger of the sexes.
Equal in worth, but different in role.
Okay. Yes, you and I can't have a baby. A woman can. But does that mean that women should stay out of the workplace?
No. Who's saying that?
Well, if you're saying that men should be the breadwinners and women just want to be taken care of and protected, that's a pretty implicit therefore out of that, is it not?
Well, Tom, you're the one that's talking about forcing people to do things. I'm talking about preserving the right to choose. If a woman would like to have a man be the provider and be able to devote her full energies to her home, that's what I want. Don't you?
And if a man wants the woman to be the provider and he wants to be a stay-at-home dad, which I spent a year at home raising our kids. My wife was off running a business that we had started, a travel agency, and doing a very good job of it. I thought I was a pretty good stay-at-home dad. I mean, it's like that's a reasonable role for men, is it not?
Well, absolutely. But the reality is that men were
defying nature,
providers and protectors, and women were designed by God to bear life and to nurture life. That's just a biological fact.
And God told you this.
Whether you believe in creation or evolution, that's just a simple fact of biological lifetime. You've acknowledged it yourself. We can't have kids. We can't feed kids. We can't nurse kids.
Yeah, and therefore, I would submit to you, and I realize that this is two men talking about women, which in and of itself is rather bizarre, but I would suggest to you that given that the vast majority of people in our prisons are men, that the vast majority of people who start and kill in wars are men, that the vast majority of people who commit crimes ranging from rape to murder are men, that the vast majority of people who commit crimes on Wall Street and destroy economies and destroy people's lives are men, that the vast majority of our banksters are men, that and the vast majority of our lawmakers are men, that if we were to say, you know, men are really screwing this thing up badly, Norway, for example, mandates that 40% of the legislature be women, and Norway has the second highest standard of living in the world, the second highest quality of life behind Denmark, where women are relatively equal with men in representation in many of these areas. Isn't it time to say, okay, you can have your ideas from your Bronze Age god about, you know, who was a guy with a penis, apparently. And maybe that was fine for 3,000 years ago, but men have been running this show for 7,000 years since Ur and Uruk and Gilgamesh and Sumeria. And we've screwed it up pretty badly. We've got all these nuclear weapons. We've got all this pollution. We've got all this poverty. Let's turn this thing over to the women for a while.
No, we don't need more role reversal, Tom. We need more Christianity.
More male-dominated religions.
Christianity teaches husbands, Tom, to be willing to lay down their lives for their wives.
Christianity also teaches, Paul said that women should shut up and sit in the back of the church.
The example of Christ.
And Christianity teaches women to shut up and be silent.
No.
Of course it does. Paul in his letter to the Romans, he says, was it Romans or Thessalonians, wherever it was. Anyway, he said the role of a woman in church is to cover her head and remain silent. You know that.
Right. What the scriptures also teach is it teaches men to lead sacrificially. Most women aren't going to have trouble following a man who provides for her and is willing to lay down his life for her. In fact, I think most women hunger for that, and that's what Christianity teaches.
Well, again, you're imagining what women are hungering for. It's hard for me to say, but of the women that I know actually would like men to treat them like equals and stop treating them like objects and stop treating them like subordinates.
Absolutely, and Christianity teaches them to treat wives with honor as fellow.
No, I'm not talking about honor like, oh, gee, you poor thing. I'm talking about you are my equal.
Absolutely. Equal in value and worth, different in role.
Yeah, and that role is a subordinate role.
That role is to nurture life.
You're the explicit in the teachings that you're promoting is that the husband is the head of the household and the woman is subordinate to him.
Well, that's what the owner's manual says, Tom. You can
Well, the owner's manual from a Bronze Age religion 3,000 years ago, yes. And if you want to go back to running around with spears wearing togas and go back to that lifestyle where a man could have 700 wives and divorce his wife by throwing her shoes outside the door, then, go ahead. But I think we've come a long way since then. And one of the things that I think we've learned is that there's been a lot of damage as a consequence of that religion and those perspectives.
No, there's not too much of that religion. It's not enough. We need more Christianity.
So we need more patriarchy and more hierarchy.
Well, Tom, you're the one that's the outlier here because according to the Pew Research, 51% of the people they surveyed said children do better if a mother is at home. Only 8% thought they did better if the man was at home. Your problem, Tom, is not with me. Your problem is with the entire
family. Well, if you're basing everything on polls, what did the polls say about the role of slavery in 1770?
Tom, how did we get to slavery in 1770?
Well, I'm saying, because the majority of the people say this is how it should be doesn't mean that that's how it should be. Anyhow, Brian, we're out of time. Brian Fisher, you can read all about it over at AFA.org, right?
AFA.net.
.net, thank you. AFA.net, the American Family Association, and host of Focal Point Radio Show, AFR.talk, or AFR Talk. Thank you, Brian.
All right, Tom.
Good talking to you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So is there too much testosterone in the world? Is it time to dial it down a little? Seems that way. Progressives know how to party. If you're in the Los Angeles area, you can join me and Lily Tomlin, Jim Hightower, John Nichols, and other special guests at the Progressive Democrats of America annual get-together and fundraiser this Saturday, day after tomorrow. June 1st, go to pdamerica.org and click the events tab for tickets and information, or click the link over at tomhartman.com. If you're in the LA area, I look forward to seeing you there. Remember it's been a couple of weeks that I went off on a fairly lengthy hour-long rant about student loans and the student debt bubble, and it's over $1 trillion and all this kind of stuff. And Obama took $84 billion away from the banksters by making public, deprivatizing the student loan business. And so now it's in the hands of Congress. And the Republicans in Congress want to double the interest rates that students pay on their loans. And I'm saying, this is the next bubble. This thing is going to burst and it's going to take down the economy. Or it's going to be a major, major problem. Particularly since when we had so-called bankruptcy reform during the Bush administration, we said that you can't dispose of your taxes in bankruptcy. Oh, and by the way, you can't dispose of student loans in bankruptcy, which makes no sense to me at all. Why should you put that category there? Well, because at that point, there was only $500 billion. And the banksters were like, hey, we can make some bucks. So here's the story. Shahil Kapoor writing over at TPMDC, Obama and GOP lock horns as student loan battle heats up. battle is heating up between President Obama and Republicans on how to prevent student loan interest rates from doubling from 3.4 to 6.8% in July. That's like 5 weeks from now. A flashpoint in the ongoing efforts of both parties to win young voters. The House Republicans recently passed their bill on a mostly party-line vote, and the White House threatened to veto it. So, you know, where is this going? We'll see. But keep your eyes on it. This is a big deal. Josie in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Josie, you wanted to talk about Brian Fisher and his opinions?
Yeah, okay. I just caught the tail end of that.
Yeah.
Also I'm going to throw a wrench into this, or a variable into this equation, okay?
Mm-hmm.
For past 45 years, I've been a male, and just this past February, I became a female.
Mm-hmm.
And, what was I going to say? And I changed my name last month. So, what am I?
Congratulations, by the way. Good on you.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. So, you know, it comes full circle with this, with the SB 10 bill.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that I was married for 13 years, three beautiful kids, and now I can't get married legally.
Because you can't get married to a woman legally, because you're a woman.
Right.
Right. Actually, Chicago, you know, Illinois may fix that today or tomorrow.
You're hoping.
Yeah, yeah, because it's already been passed by the Senate. It's before the House of Representatives, and the governor, Pat Quinn, has said he'll sign it, so we'll see. But an excellent point. But your question had to do with Brian Fisher and his stance on transgendered people like yourself?
No, it was a gentleman, the jerk, that was basically saying that we don't need women to be more prevalent, we need religion or
yeah.
Christianity.
Right. Well, what he was saying was that women shouldn't be in that it, you know, the statistic came out that 40% of heads of household, major breadwinners, are now women, married or unmarried, they're women. And he was saying, well, the role of women is to be the ones who take care of the family, not the ones who win the bread. And you know, there's a lot of women who would disagree with that. And
One now. I mean, I would disagree before when I was a male, but even more so now as a female.
There you go. Okay. Josie, you know, congratulations on your courage to make that change. If that was the right thing for you, I wish you the very best.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Sue in Canonsburg, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish TV satellite network. Hey, Sue, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's me again.
Hi, me again.
You know, I love you and Louise. God bless you both and
Thank you.
Family. Listen, this is a joke. Divorce, I'm sorry. We're supposed to take care of the family, both of us. This is more about poverty that we both have to work, because the Republicans want the gangsters and the corporations to have all the money, and one person isn't enough as a breadwinner.
I think,
and if they really cared about the family, they'd be trying to reverse all of this nonsense and be taking care of the children and taking care of the husbands and the wives. It's about the whole family. And I fought for being able to be equal. 39 years ago, I was the first woman in sales at Pitney Bowes.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't want women in the workforce then, and they still don't want them in the workforce now.
Yeah.
And then if you get divorced, the men walk away and don't want to pay for their offspring. So this is just a stupid argument on three levels that I already talked about. And there are probably about 103 levels.
I agree with you, Sue. And in fact, let me put forward my own theory on this. I believe that men are the weaker sex. They are more emotionally fragile. They are more physically fragile. And what men have done as a consequence of that is they've overcompensated, they've risen up, and they've taken power. I think this is all about power. I think patriarchy and hierarchy and male-dominated religions that have male gods exclusively, it's just all about power. And it's about suppressing female power in exchange for, you know, elevating male power. You look at 5 out of the 6 Iroquois nations that Ben Franklin and Jefferson were so fond of, although they thought they got the gender roles wrong. In 5 out of those 6 Iroquois nations, men could not vote only the women could vote because they every decision had to be made in the context of the seventh generation, and they got it that the women were connected to that in ways that men aren't. And again, I would say a weakness of men. So I think what you're seeing is reaction formation, to quote Sigmund Freud, of sorts. Sue, thank you for the call. Very well said. 27 minutes past the hour. So is there a superior and an inferior gender, or are we all in this together in different ways?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And if men are superior or inferior, why the need to oppress women? Why burkas? The very, very sesquilaterally ugly. The good. The class of 2013. According to a new study published by the Harvard Crimson, America's elite college students are starting to turn away from Wall Street careers. Only 15% of 2013 Harvard grads took a job at one of the major Wall Street banks this year, a sharp drop from the 47% who did back in 2007 before the financial crisis. Now the report shows most graduates go on toward careers in health and education. The exact reason for the plunge in budding financiers is unclear, but any sign that our best and brightest are working for the common good as opposed to being banksters? That's encouraging news. Good work, grads. The bad. Congressman Mike Pompeo, Republican from Kansas. During a recent interview on MSNBC, Kansas Republican praised the U.S. military for its treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. No, seriously, listen.
The experience I had, I had full exposure to exactly what was going on in every one of the facilities down there. I don't know what she's talking about. It is not a crisis mode.
So are you denying that there's been forced prisoners were well taken care of?
Our folks down there are doing an amazing job of doing that. The last thing to say about these folks who are assertedly hunger strikers is that they look to me like a lot of them had put on weight.
Really, Mike? You think detainees are well taken care of? The International Red Cross, as well as other human rights groups, have described force feeding as a form of torture. And by the way, the whole reason detainees are being force-fed in the first place is to counteract deadly weight loss. So your claim that they're putting on weight is just ridiculous. Just ridiculous. And the very, very ugly John Stossel. During an appearance on Fox and Friends yesterday, the libertarian pundit claimed that no one starved during the Great Depression. Seriously, take a look.
When people are needy, you want them help. But think about the Depression. That was before there was any welfare state at all. How many people starved? No one.
Actually, John, a lot of people went hungry during the Great Depression. We don't have an accurate statistic from the time period, but millions suffered from unemployment and dislocation, not to mention the Dust Bowl and crop failure. In one of the areas we do have statistics for, New York City, there were 110 recorded deaths from hunger in 1934 alone. The fact that you and your buddies over at Fox So-Called News are pushing these sort of lies, just as Congress is trying to cut billions of dollars from food stamps, well, that's just very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Boy, that's really ugly. Rick in Weston, West Virginia. Hey, Rick, you wanted to comment on the who is the stronger sex or gender?
I think...
Hey, Rick, can you take us off speakerphone?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think we're equal. Where men are a little bit weak, women still are a little bit strong. You know, it takes two to tango.
Yeah,
and this idea that a woman's got to be subservient, where's this guy? Hey, why don't you crawl back underneath this rock? Because I'll tell you a little story. My daughter did 4 tours in Iraq.
Wow.
And I could see him telling that to my daughter. He'd be picking his butt up off the floor. And I don't know where these attitudes still come. I know where they come from. The right wing of religion.
Yeah. And
it's just plain ignorance.
And I would say it's not even religion. I would say that they're using religion to justify it. You know, because, I mean, the religion reflects culture. And there's a reason, you know, yes, in the Bible it says that you should stone people to death if they wear clothing made out of two different kinds of fabric. We don't pay attention to that anymore. You know, we have moved on. There's a lot of things. You know, if your child talks back to you, you should stone them to death. We've kind of moved on from that one, too. And but they're selectively using things that were in Scripture to justify basically what I would say is misogyny, is the hatred or, frankly, the fear. I think it's fear-driven hatred of women by men. Rick, excellent point. Thank you. And our best to your daughter. I am sure you're right. David in Ducktown, Tennessee. Hey, David.
Hey. I was talking about the religion and men and all that stuff. I recently was browsing through YouTube. I came across a video called Feminism and the Disposable Male.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from this idea, especially in our culture, which seems to be very supported by your religious, you know, guest there, that men just sacrifice themselves. Doesn't matter. The boat's going down. Women and children get the boat. Doesn't matter if perhaps society or people in general would be better off if the man was survived. No. From birth, as a man, you're taught that, nope, you are disposable. You always step out of the way, and women and children always get the, you know, they get the safety, they get that. And your job is to, you know, you go and throw yourselves on the bench.
Actually, if you look back, David, if you look back at what happened when the Titanic went down, there were a lot of women and children who got left behind and drowned while wealthy men got the lifeboats.
Yeah, okay.
Back to
well,
you.
But no. You get the sentiment, though. I mean,
yeah.
It doesn't. You know,
I understand the rhetoric. I just don't think that actual history comports with the rhetoric. I think that women and children are more often the victims of men than men sacrificing themselves for them. I think women and children are the victims of male wars. They're the refugees. They're the ones left behind. They are the ones who are, you know, the most badly injured in these wars, well, other than being killed.
But what your guest was talking about is, oh, we need more Christianity. That's the idea that they want to promote. Because he said it himself. You're expected to sacrifice yourself as a husband for your wife.
Yeah. Yeah, it's high-minded rhetoric, you know. Yes, I will put my coat on the puddle for this woman to walk over. And all you have to do is insert the word fragile before the word woman, and you get what's really being said. You know, well, excellent point, David. Thank you for the call, and thanks for saying it, making it. Lewis in Chino Hills, California. Hey, Lewis, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? Love your show, by the way.
Thank you.
Wanted to comment on...
I'm surprised more women aren't calling about this, by the way. I'm getting lots of... Oh, maybe that's a woman calling. No, it's not. It's actually
yeah,
my doctor's
right.
office. Okay, so back to you.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to comment on the guy you had, the nut, the religious nut.
Mm-hmm.
Any man that's over the age of 30 that believes that men are superior to women is just basically an idiot. What bothers me is that you have these religious people, and they're trying to say things like that is the reason why this country is breaking down, when really the morality of this country is breaking down, not because women are working, but because there's, for example, 30, 40 years ago, pornography wasn't as accessible as it is now.
Right.
When you turn on the television, children the age of 5, 6, 7, 8 years old are able to watch some of the most violent things on television. Why don't the religious right attack that? You know why they don't attack it? Because a lot of the religious right, the ones that are part of the 1%, they own corporations or CEOs of corporations that, in one hand, they sit up and talk about how, you know, we're a God-fearing people,
mm-hmm.
but yet make all of these billions of dollars off of putting filth on the television for children to see.
Right.
One of the biggest reasons I feel why there's so much divorce in this country is obviously one big factor is adultery, but because nowadays men and women see so much pornography on television, or excuse me, on the internet, and there's so much accessibility. It's so easy now on the internet to just
It's largely consumed, Lewis, by men, by the way. I think it's 18% of women and 52% of men watch pornography with some frequency. I saw that statistic this morning in a New York Times article, as I recall. But I would suggest to you that the rape culture that we have been talking about on this program over the last couple of weeks. And there's been a lot of some very, very good writing about, particularly over at Alternet and some of the other websites, but particularly at Alternet, about the rape culture and this the women who were fighting back against Facebook, you know, the misogynistic stuff on Facebook, that all of this eruption of misogyny on the Internet, of women hating on the Internet, is a reaction to women having equal power to men. I just think that, you know, when you that men are fundamentally weak and insecure, and when women have power, men react that some men react that way, and men need to get over it.
You know how they can stop so much of the rape in the military?
Oh.
It's one simple reason. I never served in the military. My father, he served in the 82nd Airborne,
right,
back in the 50s. There were women in the military then.
Sure.
The difference was, my father told me, he was in for 6 years. He said there was the Women's Army Corps. I think when it comes to the military,
yeah, the
women should be absolutely allowed in the military. But when it comes to especially these combat units, there should be a separation between men and women. There was not so much of this rape going on back in the 50s.
Well, but if you look at...
My father told me...
If you look at other countries...
He was in there for 6 years. He said he never even saw women.
Yeah, no, I get that. But see, you're operating, again, on the assumption that if men see women, they can't control themselves and they rape them, and that's simply not true. And if you look at countries that have integrated combat units, like Israel, for example, you don't have as anything close to the rape problem there that we do here. And one of the reasons why is because women don't have to report rape up their chain of command. They can report it outside of the military to civilian authorities or to military authorities that are not part of their chain of command, and therefore they don't have to worry about reprisal. Because very, very often rape happens in the military by superior men, and by superior I mean higher ranking men to inferior ranking women. And this is why we keep seeing all these cases of, you know, another one just came out, I think, Lackland Air Force Base, you know, the DIs. Anyhow, Lewis, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Steve, Paul, John, Myron, Jeff, Donald, Art. No women on the board?
Ghost chickens in the sky.
Ah, welcome back. Time for our chicken, our pigeon alert. Excuse me. Ghost chickens, pigeons. Several people, actually Narlodius was the first to send this to me. Nature World News, trending topics, pigeons capable of solving complex problems. This is like a big science story? Like pigeons are really smart? They did this study, and they, you know, 70 to 90% of the time, the pigeons could choose the correct option between two strings, one attached to a reward, the other not, blah de blah de blah. Well, of course! They're robots in the planet Xenu. Of course they're intelligent, or at least semi-intelligent. They're spies sent here to spy on us, don't you know? The mothership comes down every 6 months and drops off a new batch of and brings up the old ones so that they can play back their tapes and listen to everything that's going on. Just think about it. Whenever you see important people in the world getting together, what do you have? Pigeons. Just keep your eyes open. And if you're having a really important conversation and you're walking down the street in a major city, what's walking behind you? Pigeons. I can tell you from my own experience. They're robots. They're spies. That's why you never see a baby pigeon. That's why you never see a dead pigeon. Case closed. Steve, in Clearwater, Florida, listening on WWNF. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Man, I got to tell you, a lot of these callers, and I asked your screener, sometime if you want to tell your audience a brief biography of your scholarly and academic history, it is relevant.
My scholarly and academic history is largely non-existent. So, you know, I call myself self-taught.
You've been invited personally to meet with the Dalai Lama and the Pope because of your spiritual writing.
Yeah.
And you have a huge background in that covers everything from anthropology, sociobiology. I don't think a lot of your listeners really know the depth and breadth of who you are. That's one thing I wanted to say.
Well, thank you for the kind words.
It goes completely to your topic for this hour. The dominator complex. Humans as a species love to stomp on the entire planet Earth, which is a feminine planet in the way humans use it.
Yes.
Mother Earth.
is, quote, raped by humans as a species, and that's not gender specific. The male dominator complex that views women as basically like cattle in many ways, and these father god religions that are causing so much irrationality and magical thinking always seem to embody a hierarchy where the man's on top, kicking the behind of the weaker people, whether they're women or men. Then he gets to own a woman or two and his children. And that guy you had on, I don't think he really even understands the topic he's commenting on. I don't think he even understands the history of his own holy book, and you do.
Well, I think
thanks
he
for bringing it up. And yeah, why aren't more women on this show? A lot of women have been conditioned not to participate in political talk radio.
Well, could be. Actually, a lot of women typically call. It's just I find it interesting that on this topic, I do have a woman on the board. I'm going to go to her next, Sophia. But I think that men like to talk about these things. I think the women are going, yeah. Well, let's actually ask one. Steve, thank you for your kind words. Sophia, watching Free Speech TV in Maysville, Kentucky. Your thoughts on this, Sophia?
Hey, Tom. I hope I'm not overgeneralizing here. I just kind of almost had to pull my finger out of my throat when I heard that guy talking about women hungering for a man like him to govern their lives. I think that if you're generalizing, and I realize this is generalizing, the feminine is more cooperative, perhaps, and the masculine, in general, is more competitive, perhaps. And I think it's very hard for a cooperative spirit to survive in the face of extreme aggressive competition, which we go in ebbs and flows of throughout human history. Obviously, I'm sure you know that much more than I do. Women are, we tend to be less competitive sometimes.
No, yeah, more collaborative.
But I don't know. I think that may be part of it. It's and I liked what the previous caller just said about the Mother Earth concept and how, native cultures tended to be more cooperative.
And I think that is
feminine,
pardon me. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I think that the native culture thing comes out of having seen male domination and seen it fail. When you're looking at Native American cultures, for example, you're looking at cultures that have been on this continent for 10,000 years. They've had plenty of time to work it out. Jack Forbes, who he's deceased now, but he wrote a book called Columbus and Other Cannibals. He was a professor of Native American Studies at University of California, Davis. And I went out and interviewed him when I was writing Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And he said, my people, the Native American people, he said, when you white people first showed up on our shores, you were infected by a mental illness. We called it wetiko. It's a spiritual and intellectual and emotional mental illness of male domination and basically rape, rob, and pillage. And he said the problem that we were confronted with as the people who had fully populated every square inch of this continent, the problem that we were faced with is we could fight it, but then we would become it. We could lay down and die, but then it would wipe us out. Or we could run away from it, but eventually it would catch us. And most of us who survived just ran away from it. The ones who fought lost, and the ones who or became it. And he described this as wetiko, this cultural mental illness. And I think that in many ways this is also the story of men and women. And at least in the 50s. I mean, this is kind of the Mad Men complex. Am I making sense?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm a baby boomer, so I get you there.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, I don't want to take any more of your time. I really appreciate all your insights. And women are trying to call. They just can't necessarily get through.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sophia. I appreciate it. And on that, we will end today's show. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. That means it's Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here talking about the important issues of the week and Anything Goes Friday. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get over to movetoamend.org or free-don.com. That's a pretty amazing site, free-don.com. Or pdamerica.org, and especially if you're in the L.A. area, come on out and hang out with us on Saturday. Tag You're It. See you tomorrow.
You've
been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.